sit back, relax. Nevada Backcountry coming up this hour. Dave, good to see you again.
Yeah, good seeing you too after a little holiday stint and
illness, holidays, time off of work, the whole nine, man. Let's jump into, I guess we'll call this the week of weird animal stuff or weird animal videos.
Yeah, some weird stuff has been coming across your phone and my phone. People sending us some
videos
really cool
and pictures. Yeah.
Pictures, and the video that got sent to me is just trippy.
Yeah, so that's what I wanted to talk about right out of the gate because I did the episode with my dad. We talked a lot about predators.
Yeah.
And that video was brought up, and at the time I was kind of cagey. I didn't want to confirm anything about it as far as where it was or until I had a chance to talk to you. You sent me a video of five mountain lions traveling together.
Yeah.
In 051.
051, yeah. The hunter was just glassing the hillside, and he saw these animals. He was like, what the heck? So he videoed it, which was super cool, through his scope.
You know, phone scope thing.
Yeah. And yeah, it's five mountain lions following each other like a pack of wolves, just cruising across the open.
My dad used the
hillside
example, a pride of lions.
Yeah,
like
pride
something
of
you'd
lions
see in Africa.
Exactly. Yeah. And it looks like there's only maybe one or two of them might be younger.
Yeah.
But the other three in the lead
look
mature. They're big lions, and they're just all cruising together.
What's your take, lion population in the state? On the up?
Yeah, it's kind of increased, stable but increasing.
Okay.
The kicker with Nevada, from what I've read and from what I've understood, is that there's a disproportion of males to female ratio. You know, like in most states, they try to maintain a certain percentage male-female correlation. And Nevada, we're a lot more males than females, and that may be due to our partner state on the west here does not allow harvesting of mountain lions,
right,
and male mountain lions are very territorial. So as they start getting kicked out of territories and pushed around and stuff, we end up with...
Cross the border they come. Oh,
okay.
So
we end up with extra... And they can travel, I mean, crazy amounts of distances. There's been some studies where they've had collared mountain lions in the Sierra Range, the Lake Tahoe area and the Pine Nuts. And they had a couple mountain lions that would travel all the way down to Bishop.
Whoa.
And then they would loop back around into Nevada, like central Nevada, and then loop all the way through. And then 3 months later, end back up in Tahoe. Just following food. And cool thing is that they've shown through other studies that in Nevada, the mountain lions primarily feed on feral horses.
I know. I love that.
That's so cool.
As much as I, anecdotally talking to hunters, talking to guides, people out in the mountains all the time, everybody kind of has this opinion right now, like the mountain lion population is going up. It's anecdotal.
Yeah.
But it's just what they're seeing. But everybody's kind of in that same or has that same mindset I do, where it's like, yeah, you hate the impact on the elk and the deer, but at the same time, it's the only predator on the landscape taking down feral horses. So it's a love-hate relationship.
Yeah, exactly.
More weird stuff. Let's talk about this picture I got of a deer with lady bits. Confirmed when the hunter gutted it and everything, it had ovaries. Whole nine, had hard horns.
Yeah.
Or spike.
Yeah.
It's two spikes anyway.
Yeah, so it isn't uncommon. It can be rare, but it does happen. What happened is that the animals end up just producing a higher level of testosterone. The females will. And with that, they'll end up with some antler growth. Usually, depending on the level of testosterone that they're producing, they'll have like a button buck, little buttons on the top
of
their head.
Right, right.
But they can go all the way up to, there was a hunter in Montana a couple years back that shot a small, like really small 3-point, and it was a doe.
Okay.
And it was a mule deer.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a mule deer antlered doe.
Okay.
So it just depends on their testosterone level. They can start building that up, and they will end up having antlers. But sometimes they don't produce enough of the testosterone. Usually they stay in velvet, if they have enough testosterone. So it's kind of like a scale.
Okay.
If they're producing more testosterone, then they'll go to a hard horn.
Yeah, that's the picture I got. Yeah. It's hard horns. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's a spike that you had, that picture. It's cool. Right. And then they may not produce enough testosterone to actually drop the antler.
So it just goes through so its just, life with
yeah, a... they'll have a, you know, a spike or what have you, maybe a branch or two. But they generally don't get very big. They're very spindly. You're not going to find a doe that's a...
160 class deer.
Yeah. It's not going to happen. So,
okay.
So that's why you're going to find does at times, very rare, but with horns or with antlers. So, and that's one reason why a lot of states years ago quit with the male and female hunts. And that's why they've gone to antlered hunts and antlerless hunts.
Okay.
For that particular reason.
So it's more, it's weird. I've never stumbled across it before. So it is a, it's more common than I would have guessed. And you were saying, before we jumped into the show, you were telling me what, like caribou is a perfect example where the females, they'll have antlers and they just keep it.
Yeah. The females caribou will have antlers just like the males do. They're generally smaller. It's due to, you know, they're very large herds, and they actually do use the antlers to fend off and fight other caribou, male and female, for food rights, for their like little plot of land that they're feeding on.
Okay.
So they'll use it for that reason. And generally, the female, just like males, the female with the largest antlers ends up being the dominant female.
Yeah.
And so, like we were talking earlier, so... And they generally won't drop them as well. They can, depending on their testosterone levels, they can drop the antlers and then they'll come back again. But so there's a big controversy that Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was actually a female.
Yeah, what was it doing with antlers at Christmas time?
Exactly. There's a lot of talk about it. It's like, well, what's going on there? And then Clarice, you know... kind of changes the entire dynamic of that Christmas show.
And here, I always thought you had to go to Midtown to find females with too much testosterone. But apparently, you can.
On that note. But that's also kind of goes on the reverse side for the males, because you'll have a buck, like we were talking before.
Cactus bucks
are some of the really, really insane, crazy non-typicals you'll see. Those are males that generally have not dropped their testicles.
Hormone issue.
It's a hormone issue, correct. Okay. So they won't drop the antlers as well, and they'll just keep adding to those antlers year after year after year. And then you get these crazy-looking cactus bucks or these insane-looking non-typical paddled crazy things.
Yeah, and a cactus buck, they're actually squishy.
Yeah.
It's not like it doesn't go hard-horned.
Yeah.
Which is just crazy.
It's wild. So.
Have you ever seen one in the wild?
No, I have not.
I haven't either.
We, quite some time ago, back in the 90s, we came across a buck, and this muley had so many points, we could not, even with the spotting scope, we could not count all of the points on his
just
left
junk
and right
everywhere.
Side. He just had junk dropping and crossing over, and He was just a massive buck, but it could have been, you know,
cactus,
one of these cactus or just crazy non-typicals or something. But
right, because the cactus looks very distinct, that warty, knobby.
Yeah, and it's kind of thinned out on the lower part of the antler.
Goofy-looking things.
Had them in my hands at shows and stuff that people have brought them.
Same thing. At shows, you'll see them every now and then. It's kind of like, oh, look at that. New show sponsor, Hunt and House Archery Center over there off Longley Lane here in Reno. For everybody listening, if you're looking for Christmas gifts, it's not just an archery shop. They've got everything from boots to packs, knives, arrows, you name it. Right now, they're doing a special 2023 and 2024 flagship bows. Go in, pick one up, and you get a free dozen arrows of your choice. So go see the guys over at Hunt and House Archery Center off Longley in Reno. When we come back, let's talk a little commission meeting stuff. Let's talk some sheep issues.
Yeah.
And go from there.
Let's do it.
Thanks for hanging in there over the break. Let's jump back into I don't want to be too negative about this. We'll call it sheep issues.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, let's go. I got with a some video sheep issues.
I'll post to our social media
that I sent
accounts.
You?
Yeah.
Is that the coffee?
The pneumonia. Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things I saw, a survey that went on in the, I always screw up the name, Dave, but the National Desert or Desert National Wildlife Refuge or whatever down south there.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
It was like the sheep numbers were 50% of what they had been the previous year during a survey. Yeah. Getting gnarly.
Yeah, well, some areas in Nevada have seen 60% decline in herds.
Yeah, that's what you were saying.
Yeah, it's pneumonia.
Okay.
It's the pneumonia that is kind of running through the herds right now. So pneumonia started with the domestic sheep, you know, the intermingling of domestic sheep with wild sheep. You know, wild sheep were never exposed to it. The domestic sheep have it, and sometimes they're just carrying it, and it's not a big deal.
No signs or symptoms.
To them, correct. Right. Yeah, because they're just kind of hosts. They're just kind of carrying it as they're cruising around. And,
okay.
And they'll mingle with sheep. That's why when you go into an endow office and you've harvested a sheep, it's one of the big questions is did you see any domestic sheep during your hunt?
Right.
You know, that's super important to know. So then the department can kind of get ahead of that. But now, with it being so prevalent in some of the herds, the transmission, the pneumonia, is now 90% wild sheep to wild sheep.
Oh.
Yeah. So okay. It becomes an issue. You know, some of the clinical signs that you'll see when people are out and about, and we really want our listeners to be aware of this when you are out and about and you're in sheep country and you're watching sheep or you see sheep, is they have like a really deep guttural cough. And you'll see it in the video if you click on it.
Yeah.
And into the link and see that nasty, like, entire body shaking cough. So what they're trying to do is obviously get that out of their throats and out of their nasal passages, you know, just like we would when we're trying to hack a big loogie up or something. That's what they're doing. You'll see the, like, nasal discharge. You'll see if you're checking them out through binoculars or spotting scopes or something, their nose will be super-duper wet. And sometimes have some, like, you know, they'll be licking it. Their nose will be licking it because they're just dripping snot.
Okay.
So, which is kind of sucks. You'll see them wheezing and they'll, like, labored breathing. You'll see them kind of like their necks will extend out as like they're trying to grab air because they're wheezing and trying to laboring for their breath. You also see that when they're coughing, their entire body will shake. And with severe cases, you can't miss it.
Right.
You just can't miss it. Earlier cases, you want to take a really good look at the nose and see what kind of if there's any kind of discharge or anything like that, or if they're extending their necks out really far and opening their mouth or trying to get some air in and stuff. So
I got to ask you, I think we chatted about this a little bit when we had Lydia Teal on, the NBU vice president. I mean, what mitigation stuff is in place? I'm not a fan of I'm just not a fan of government interference in 99.1% of cases.
Good one.
But you know, in this case, it's kind of like, why wouldn't they just basically put the kibosh on sheep herding in units with large wild sheep populations?
The State Department of Wildlife can't do that.
Oh, they can't.
Don't have regulatory authority over grazing rights. That is a federal thing.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a federal thing. And 90% now of transmission is
wild sheep to wild sheep.
Because it's the domestic sheep and wild sheep that has been discussed with federal partners and herders and stuff for decades.
Okay.
It's been well discussed, and the self-mitigation of that, making sure that their sheep aren't near herds and stuff, seems to have gone fairly well. It's not like back in the 80s and 90s where you saw it and heard it quite a bit that, oh man, domestic sheep are in with the sheep in the Montanas or whatever it may have been. It's gotten a lot better.
The communication
and the understanding of what the skinny is. So now with 90% sheep to sheep, wild sheep to wild sheep, it's a whole nother battle.
Okay.
And it takes a lot of work, a lot of effort, and the state biologists that are in charge are doing a phenomenal job. I got to tell you, they spend hundreds of hours in the field watching sheep, checking sheep, so that they don't have or they can get ahead of these situations when they do start seeing a sick herd. The one thing you don't want is a sick herd intermingling with a healthy herd. When there's those kinds of a situation where you have a herd that is known and tested now and it's showing pneumonia, and then two ridges over, you've got a good healthy herd has nothing. That becomes a massive issue because the biologists have to monitor that. And then as much as it pains the agencies, is sometimes the hard decision, and it is an incredibly hard decision to make, is to eliminate the sick herd.
I was going to ask what tools are at their disposal as far as can you eliminate, based on what you just said, I answered my own question. You can't eradicate sick animals.
Yeah, now there's a lot of factors that go into play there. You want to find out the size of the herd, sick herd. Thing is, you don't want to go in there and whack 25, 30 sheep in a herd or something. There's a lot of variables that are moving around during those decision-making processes. You know, if you have a herd that's solo by itself, you don't worry about it. It's not going to get into another healthy herd or what have you. Just kind of let it run its course, and the healthy ones will work through it and survive and then build the herd back up. And granted, that may take 5, 10, 20 years, but it's better than eliminating the herd entirely and then figuring out how can we now get sheep back in here. And
how do they make that determinant? Is it just like a geographical, oh, there's no way they would cross this canyon to get there? How do they make the determination like that it's not possible for this herd to move to that herd?
With all the research that's been done on sheep nationwide, collaring them and everything, they have a very good understanding of how far sheep will move.
Okay.
So that is a big determiner in...
They basically have like a radius, okay, yeah. Outside of that, we're safe.
Exactly. And then, again, it'll come down to the number in the sick herd, the number in the healthy herd, proximity, and if it's right on the edge, it may be one of those situations like, well, we just need to stay really diligent about monitoring these animals and make sure there's nothing crossing. And if they start getting closer together, then it goes into a whole nother conversation of next steps. There's no textbook. You open page 17.
And do this.
And then you do this.
I mean, spitballing, but thinking this through as we're talking about this, let's say you've got a healthy herd of sheep, one canyon or one ridgeline over, whatever. And it looks like they're going to at some point intermingle with a sick herd of sheep. Could you use helicopters, push the healthy herd out, sort of push them off that area?
I mean, that I don't know if that they'd go to the extent of trying to push them. So you got to be careful with that, because just because you're moving them or pushing them to three ridges over, that three ridges over may not have the elements to sustain a population. It may not have the water. Yeah. It may not have the food.
They're where they are for a reason.
Exactly. They're where they are for a reason. It fits all of their criteria. So you push them somewhere else, and you know, then you also have issues with predation and whatever else it might be. So
I mean, we relocate sheep all the time in the state.
That's not done in the context of like, let's throw a dart and see where on the mountain we want to put these things.
There's studies done
over and over and over again. And I mean, there's vegetation plots that are analyzed for like growth and determining if it's going to be a suitable area for 20 sheep, 30 sheep, 40 sheep. Is it going to regenerate? Are we going to green up enough to where these animals are going to have food throughout the year? Is there a large enough water source? Do we need to bring in a guzzler?
Right.
You know, all of those factors come into play, and then after it checks all the boxes, then the conversations start with the other states that have sheep and, you know, the horse trading of like, okay, you know, because that kind of stuff happens. But Department of Wildlife has a fantastic relationship with the California Fish and Game and Oregon and Idaho and all of our surrounding states, where they talk a lot about herds that are crossing borders, because they may have a sick herd that we don't know about. We're not studying anything in their state. The Department of Wildlife can't go over there. And
let's talk about a little more positive stuff coming up after the break.
Let's do it.
Commission, some good news out of the commission meetings.
Some cool news. It just depends on the listeners. See what they say.
All right. So we'll do that. Shout out to Truck Envy, South Virginia Street right here in Reno. The colder it gets, man, you don't want to sleep in the back of your truck under the stars anymore. Go see them for a camper shell. They've got insulated options. You name it, they'll take care of you. Go see Andy and the guys at Truck Envy. Listening to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk and Nevada Backcountry with me, Henry Evans, and David Catalano.
That's me.
All right, so we got two options here. We could talk commission meeting stuff, or we could talk archery releases.
Let's jump into the commission stuff.
We'll end on archery releases.
Yeah, well, so this last November, a couple days ago, weeks ago, man, time is going by, dude.
Too fast.
So fast.
So
already December.
It was back beginning of the month,
November 3rd was commission. I was there, and there is a commission policy called Commission Policy 24. Now, there has not been a lot of public comment on this particular policy, which kind of amazed me.
And what is it? What's Policy 24?
So Policy 24 is, it used to be called the Demand Success Formula for Providing tags, how the calculation is on the hunt groups, you know, any legal weapon and then the primitive weapons.
Right, right.
Muzzle loader and archery. And it has now been changed to fixed allocation tag system.
Okay, and why the change?
Policy basically is the commission has a duty to provide hunting opportunities to Nevadans. So the policy is basically the harvest levels of big game species based on a fixed allocation for the various weapon types and hunter groups for hunters' opportunities, and to incorporate the hunter success rates for those particular weapon groups. So it's trying to help redistribute the tags to, one, allow more people to get in the field to experience and enjoy, you know, family and social activities out there and a good protein source.
More Nevadans to get
into
the field.
Yes, more Nevadans. Yeah. Yeah. So this is not a non-resident deal. So the non-resident tag allocation will continue to stay at the non-resident limit.
So this is a good thing for Nevadans.
It is. So basically, what it'll end up doing, in a nutshell, it'll end up providing more tags to the primitive weapon classes.
Muzzleloader and archery. Very cool.
So, yeah. So, those will start getting more allocated tags to them.
Now, we've talked before, and I don't want to sidebar too far when you're rolling here, but we've talked before about, like, the overall number doesn't change, right? So, if you have 300 total tags, that 300 doesn't increase or decrease.
No.
It's just going to shuffle the allocation of those.
Correct. It's a new algorithm, basically, or a calculation to distribute those tags based on a success rate. So there are some numbers that they do propose in the report here. So for a standard, fixed allocation will be set as follows. So any legal weapon will get 57%, archery 10%, muzzleloader 8%. So that is an increase of, in some cases, in some units, archery gaining up to 73% more tags than they did in the previous year, and muzzleloader receiving 56 more tags from the previous year.
Okay, wait. Say those percentages again, though, because I had like 18% between muzzleloader and archery, and 57, that doesn't add up to 100. So where are the other?
Well, that's their increase from what they
were. Oh, that's the increase, not the breakdown.
That's not the breakdown. That's the level of increase. So here, let me give you guys an example. So this is a mule deer antlered hunt.
Archery or?
This is across the board. So in 2023, the tag allocation was for any legal weapon was 5,342 tags.
Okay.
For archery, resident archers was 3,985 tags. Okay. For resident muzzleloader was 455 tags. So the overall state tag allocation was 10,783 tags.
Okay.
With this new format for the tag success allocation, it would move to any legal weapon would drop down to 4,910 tags.
Okay.
So that would be a decrease of 18%. Then for archery, it would be an increase to 2,136 tags, an increase of 7% or so. And then muzzleloaders would go from 455 to 871 tags. So that's
why is muzzleloader so dang low?
I don't know.
No, is that just...
It's just, I think, just how the numbers kind of roll out. But that's part of this new policy, Commission Policy 24, is to help redistribute those tags to be right. A little more friendly.
Because as we're talking about this and I think about that, I've always said I'll buy a muzzleloader when I draw a muzzleloader tag. And I put in for it, but I've drawn rifle tags, I've drawn archery tags, I've never drawn a muzzleloader tag.
Well, do you put muzzleloader as your, like, not your first choice though, right?
Some units for elk, yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
You just have crappy luck.
So I've never had an excuse to buy a muzzleloader.
Yeah. So I'm going to read one section out of the commission. So in January commission, which is going to be in Las Vegas, this is going to be a votable policy. So they were able to vote on it in November to approve it or not. The commission wanted to see a few changes done to it, and those changes have pretty much been just about made.
Okay.
So this will get reread, represented with the changes in January. This will go into the 2024 draw. This will be the new way of doing our draws.
Man, that's going to be quick. Okay. They'll implement this by 2024.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So one of the big components here is since Nevada being relatively low wildlife numbers across the state and an increased human population, which we're like the second highest growth state in the country or something crazy like that, it's become necessary to manage our wildlife a little differently and provide hunting opportunities across the state. So I'm going to read this one section here, number 7. It is out of the findings, basically the state findings that support this change, is when given the option, hunters overwhelmingly choose any legal weapon hunts on their big game applications. However, hunters generally experience higher success rates during any legal weapon season than other weapon groups, i.e. muzzleloader and archery, the primitive weapons. Higher success rates yields fewer tags when expanding desired harvests to tag quotas. So the commission has adopted a fixed allocation tag success formula. For determining tag quotas. In most cases, this will result in the redistribution of desired harvests from any legal weapon to primitive weapon groups, i.e. archery and muzzleloader, yielding a greater number of tags available for primitive weapon hunters.
Okay.
So that's kind of the gist of this policy 24.
You've seen it as well as I have. There are more people that hunt with a rifle.
Yeah.
And there are more people that put in for those any legal weapon tags, and success rate's much higher. So it makes sense.
Yeah, so as a success rate goes higher the next year, the tags can drop down,
right.
can decrease because of those higher numbers. So there's pages and pages and pages of information here. There are examples within the policy, the pages that go through like what would a fixed allocation tax success calculation look like for antelope, for elk, for deer, you know. So it'll go through all of that within the document here. So if you are interested, it is on the Nevada Department of Wildlife, the endow.org website. You click into the commissions.
Okay.
It's on the upper bar, right-hand side. You can click that. We'll put a link in there. We'll put a link on our site for you to get in there. You'll be able to look at this policy as it lives and breathes right now and be able to read it and understand it. So little caveat, though, within this document, they do have an antlered moose hunt. That does not mean we are going to have, or the Department of Wildlife is going to have, an antlered moose hunt. It is merely placed inside this policy 24 for the possibility of a future hunt for antlered moose. So it's being placed in there as a placeholder so that the document does not have to go through these steps again for an amendment down the road. So
I gotta be honest. I gotta be honest with you. I do not see Nevada having a moose hunt.
There's every year people are seeing more and more and more moose in that particular area and in areas around it. So they're expanding a bit. So
I've heard as far south as like Wells.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
There's a reason why it's in the policy. I mean,
Good point. Possibly
conversation about it, or at least the thought of like, hey, let's put it in there just in case it does come to fruition eventually.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You would know better than I do. Let's take a break. Hey, you're listening to Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. When we come back after the break, we'll talk a little bit about archery releases. Stay tuned. Man, towards the tail end of that segment there, I heard moose, Nevada, and I got sidetracked. But you said meeting in January, right?
Yeah, in January in Las Vegas. The commission meeting will be in Las Vegas. You can go online and provide comments online if you wish to. You can get on there, read through the policy. Again, it's Commission Policy 24.
Okay.
Read through it, check it out, and you can provide comments, or you can digitally get on the meeting. The agenda will be online, so you'll know when to jump on, so you're not sitting there for 2 days on
waiting. Okay.
And you'll know when to get online, and when they ask for public comments, then you can, I think there's a little handshake button.
Okay.
You can push and it'll raise your hand. Then they'll call on you and you can provide your comments to Commission Policy 24.
And as this stuff comes out, obviously, we'll keep everybody listening.
Yeah, keep everyone posted.
Usually, we like to read through stuff before we actually go live with it. What's the old, I'd rather be right than first?
Yeah. We'll keep everyone posted as well on the sheep, you know, some of the sheep stuff going on. So if you're out in the field and you do see this, and you do have a concern of a sheep herd or an individual that you're checking out, just hit your Onyx, get the location, and report it to the Nevada Department of Wildlife. They will get on that and check it all out.
When you check out our social media, Nevada Backcountry stuff, you'll see the video. It is very, very distinct. You'll know what you're looking at. It's not a... Enough about that. Man, that bums me out.
I know, right? Sure,
but so let's talk about... I'll let you do the deep dive. I'm going to give a kind of a cursory overview of types of archery releases. You've got your typical, what I think, 92.3% of archers are familiar with the index finger, the wrist rocket.
Yeah,
you can pick
trigger,
up a, yeah.
a trigger release.
I've even seen them at Walmart before.
Oh, they're
everywhere.
Yeah, they are by far the most popular release for hunters and 3D competitors. On the market. I mean, it's the go-to.
It's what everybody thinks of when you picture an archery release. Then you've got a thumb button, similar style mechanism.
Yeah.
However, you hold it and your thumb actually activates the release.
Yeah.
Generally, they don't have a wrist strap. Sometimes they do. Then you've got a resistance release, which essentially you've got a pull and put pressure on it and it will release at a certain poundage.
Correct.
Once it hits that. And then you've got what most people see in the target archery realm, a hinge release.
Yeah.
So, Dave, now we can do deep dive. Pros and cons of each style.
So, you know, first off, you'll get a lot of information out there that folks are like, well, if you want to be a really good shooter and you want to be competitive, then you need to go to a back tension release, or you need to go to a thumb button, or it really comes down to what is the most comfortable release to you. And the biggest thing is, what is the most consistent to you? When you come to your full draw and you come to your anchor, are you consistently coming to the exact same spot every time? And when that thing does go off, when that does release, does it feel right? There are pros out there that shoot the trigger releases.
Tim Gillingham, famously.
Tim Gillingham, yep. Levi Morgan will shoot the trigger in some ASA tournaments. I mean, there's a lot of them. They'll go to the
trigger style.
To Old Faithful, the trigger style. But then across the board, you'll have pros that'll shoot the thumb buttons, the hinges, the back tensions, you name it. It's a mix.
I will say I hunt with an index or with a wrist rocket. I know you hunt with a hinge.
Yeah.
I hunt with an index because, and this is my reasoning, my screw ups with an index are not as big as they are with a hinge. I can punch an index and still be fairly accurate.
Yeah.
I rip a hinge, you're talking feet.
It can be, yeah. And that's one of the big things is, you know, with all of these releases, the shot should be a surprise. And
yes.
You know, you'll see people that sit there and you can literally watch their fingers like just cranking that trigger.
Yeah.
That is improper form. That's not how you shoot these things. But 99% of people, that's how they do it. They shoot these releases wrong.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't matter that the trigger release, it doesn't matter if it's the hinge or a tension release. The tension releases are really nice if you can figure them out. They're very good because you can fine-tune that tension based on the poundage of your bow and how your draw cycle is. And it also has a safety feature on it. It looks like a thumb button. So you hold the thumb button in, and as you're drawing, it will not let go. It basically locks the caliper in place. So if you're holding that, you're not going to have a draw fire. So that's a big bonus. You're not going to have any kind of misfires or anything like that because it's locked. But as soon as you come to your anchor and you're in there and it's comfortable, then you roll that thumb off of that button, and now she's ready to rip. And as you keep pulling, squeeze your shoulder blades together and creating that increase in tension on the string and the release, at a certain point that you've pre-adjusted, it'll just rip. Caliper will open and the string will go.
Can you re-engage the thumb safety? For like, I'm thinking hunting scenario, you come to full draw.
You can, yes. If you go back in and you grab that thumb button and compress it back down.
So you can let down the bow.
It will lock.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's no click. The hinges and some other releases, they have a click.
Before it goes off,
it kind of lets you know, okay, you're at the last hair's width before this thing rips.
Right.
So those do not. That's strictly tension. So you can, you know, the animal runs off, you're like, oh, crud.
You want to let down.
You just hold the button back in and bring it back in, and it locks it.
Okay.
So that's the beauty of a tension release, back tension release. Then you've got your trigger releases, you know, like we were saying, the most common ones. So there's two forms of those. You've got your single caliper and you have your double caliper.
Oh, yeah. The jaws.
The jaws,
oh,
yeah.
Right.
They call them the jaws. So most people prefer the single. It's a smoother release and it's a more consistent release. The jaw one or the double caliper one has error because they don't open precisely at the same time every time.
Oh.
So you can get what's called string draw. So like the string will catch on one and then that'll change. That can change the consistency of the release and the placement of the arrow.
You know, I'll be honest. I'm thinking about mine right now. I don't know if it's a dual caliper or a single caliper.
Oh.
The one I hunt with. Scott Echo. I don't know.
But yeah, the Echo, I think, is a double.
Dual? Okay.
It's a dual. It's a dual. So most prefer the single.
Gotcha.
Prefer the single caliper. Now, the double caliper is used quite a bit when you're talking the thumb button releases.
Oh, right.
That
okay.
people hunt with.
Yep.
Because if you've got the double on that, it'll click in, and then your release can just hang off of your D-loop.
Right.
So
right.
you're ready to rock and roll.
I could see that being, I don't know, Western-style hunting. I don't know if I would trust a thing hanging as I'm
yeah.
on a stalk.
Oh, yeah.
No. Tree stand, 100%. I click that thing on there, leave it.
And you're ready to go. Yeah. yeah. No, our type of hunting in Nevada, the spot and stalk stuff, it would be, for one,
I'd lose it.
Well, I'd lose it, and it'd drive me bonkers as it bounced around there. Yeah. So. But the hinge release is probably one of the more difficult mm-hmm. ones to get used to. Now, they're relatively basic and they're user-friendly.
Yes.
Once you figure them out. So these are the type of release that the caliper is a single caliper. It hooks to your D-loop or your torqueless D-loop. And the angle of the release kind of locks it in as mm-hmm. you draw. The big problem that can come up is... as you're learning this thing, and I suggest if you do try one of these, drop your bow down to, you know, whatever, 45, 50 pounds so you're not trying to kill yourself, as well as get 5 feet from the bale.
Yep.
The biggest thing is during the draw cycle, folks will rotate their hand during the draw because they're used to either a trigger finger or a tension release.
Okay.
So the hands are a little different. And they'll start rotating their hand, and that thing will go off in mid-draw.
Yeah.
And either they'll end up losing a tooth or two, or their arrow goes into the neighbor seven streets down.
Yeah.
Fence or house.
On that note, let's get out of here. Hey, thank you, everybody, sincerely, for tuning in to Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and 92.3. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention our last sponsor, Out West Buildings, and Legacy Sports International. You guys, go support the businesses that bring you this content. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week.